Mr. Forbes, Real 8. Now, we were talking about Goodwood, and it's clear, as you said, that you don't remember this that day at all. And you don't really know why you weren't in the main thrust of the battle.
Well,
you've got some impressionistic memories, though, you know, the things you just...
Yeah.
But you don't know what was happened to you, really.
No, I don't. I can't even remember why the crew got split up again. Because you had the feeling that we were all wondering about not knowing what to do when after the aftermath of Goodwood, the first day, when we lost so many tanks, and you heard so much bad news about various chums and that were lost, and B Squadron lost quite a few. Ken Gilmore. There's quite a few, I remember. No.
Did you lose any particular friends?
No, well, Ken Gilmore was a friend of mine. Who else was there? Well, there's quite a few. A chap called Hyam, I never knew his first name. I just used to call him Hy. He was one of the ones that we... Oh, and Bob Smithhurst is another one. He was in our troop.
You helped some of the casualties on the way back, I believe.
Yeah, after the bombing, it was... when we got in underneath that thing, that were like sardines, you know, we're all... some of us were that way, and some of us were the other way. And it was a question of how much... protection you could get behind the bogey heels of it, because the stuff was, the bombs were landing all around the vehicles. There was an awful lot of luck too, because an awful lot of the bombs went landed in the open, and it was shrapnel. It was I can remember these bombs seemed to, I think they were quite a lot of anti-personnel type things, you know, that spread the shrapnel about. Anyway, one or two of the chaps that were in underneath got wounded. Of course, when we got Jimmy Fraser and Johnny Murray out, we had to sort of manhandle them across the rest of the field. And I can remember them getting them on this... Bren gun carrier thing. Who drove it, I'm not sure. But it was difficult to get them on because they were both wounded in the posterior, you see. And it was difficult to get them on, settled. And after that, when most of the wounded that were cleared away, we just sort of wandered about aimlessly. I think they're sort of what you might call bomb happy, you know, is the word. And I discovered that an artist with his easel painting, and I think it was a chap called Trevelyan. He's one of the war artists. In fact, these pictures are in the Tate Gallery, some of them. I think his name was Trevelyan. So, I spent quite a long time standing chatting to him, being interested in painting and that myself.
And
not much more significant things happened there until we got sorted out and paraded and reallocated to what LOB tanks came up. There was always a column of Shermans behind the, you know, amongst the rear troops ready to, you never, it was like falling off your horse, you were back in again, you know, you just, as soon as you were bombed out, you were in another, next day you were in another tank.
But you hadn't been bombed out, you don't know why you were out of your tank group.
No, I was a bit, I had trouble with I had a sickness. And I thought, at the time we got back to this harbour, I was suffering. Men living on the rations that we were living on had stomach trouble. A lot of us had stomach trouble. There was a sort of allocation of places for people having a rest, a period of rest, in the trucks. Now that's probably what happened to me, I think, because that's when I met the sergeant who was gone. And there was four others, two tank drivers and myself from three squadrons. One of them had, we thought it was some kind of meningitis or something. Emma was kind of worried about him. That's right, that's probably what happened. And I can remember seeing the railway line at Goodwood. And I can remember getting pretty badly mortared in B echelon. But they were very good at digging slit trenches. They had some deep slit trenches.
So as far as you were concerned, you probably stayed in B echelon throughout the battle?
Practically, yes, until the end. Because I came up when the tanks were coming back, I'm sure. I can remember being in a firefly. Was it a reserve one or something?
So you just don't really know. I mean, it's not a problem, you know.
No, I'm a bit hazy there. There's quite a few of us at that stage. After the show in Hill 112, there was quite a few sickness casualties.
How bad were you?
Damn. Very, very
was it dysentery or was it constipated? It was the other way.
They're very bad. Days and days without. Anyway, after that, the chaos seemed to disappear and we got organised again.
And this would be when you were at Ardennes. There's a lager at Demouville, and then you were at Ardennes Abbey for a week. And you mentioned a
yes,
religion.
That's right, yes.
And when did you think you? When did you get back sorted with a crew that you knew? This is when you were the Firefly with.
Well, when we started to move west, when we started to go across to Tilly, somewhere.
Just generally in the fighting in August.
Yeah.
So that's when you were definitely in a firefly with Shaw, Moyer and Mathers.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Now what's the first... I don't expect you to be able to remember day by day through this because it's very confusing.
It's impossible to go back to day by day unless you kept a diary, but I should have kept a diary. Everybody should have had some kind of a diary. But I never kept a diary, and I never... I can't trust my memory regarding movements from A to B. Incidents sometimes come back to mind quickly. Well,
what was the nature of the fighting? And perhaps just give some illustrations of incidents so we can perhaps sort out where they were. What sort of terrain were you advancing through? This is when, you know, the late August, you started moving around Caumont and Martin, St. Martin de Bessas, yeah. and onto the Veer Road fighting.
Yeah, yeah. Well, on the Veer sector, it was very... the Bocage country was very hazy, small fields and little copses and undulating landscape, but wasn't very good for the tanks at all.
Could you go through the hedges, or would you, I mean, you know, with a tank?
A lot of them you could. A Sherman could bounce over a hedge, and unless it was a particularly steep bank and the hedge was at the top of it. But usually you didn't go through, you stopped there and waited whole zone and watched until it was time to advance again, and then I don't think that we deliberately destroyed the countryside if we could avoid it, you know.
When you went down, would you go down the roads or would you go through the fields, or which?
I think if there was a road, we would stick to it, because a danger from meeting something that a tank would get easily bogged down or disabled. I mean, sometimes, like if a tree trunk or something could get wedged between your sprocket and that, and your tracks would break, and you're faced with the hard job of reassembling them again. You carried spare track pins, you see, and you had equipment for putting your tracks back on again, but sometimes it was impossible, depending on where they were. I mean, you'd have to get the LED up to do that.
Would the tracks ever just go slack? Did you tighten your tracks?
No.
Take pins out to tighten them.
You mean, is there any adjustment on them? Well, there's adjustment on the idlers. That's these things here. That's not a very good model as far as the sprocket and that's concerned. But,
They didn't take pins out then, because a plate out just to tighten the track. That wasn't something you'd
do.
No. Well, when you were going through, were you very aware of the risk from bazookas, or Panzerfaust as they call it, or had that not arrived yet?
Generally speaking, they were very menacing as far as going along the roads was concerned, because they dug these little foxholes, and they would hide in them until you were within range of that Panzerfaust, bazookas as we call them, and they can knock out a tank easily, especially when the fire in there is soft, thin.
Into the side, inside the tracks area. They'd already started with that in the Bocage country.
I don't think it was many. We didn't meet that to any great extent until we went well into Germany.
So that was a later, but you had a few of them earlier on.
I wouldn't like to say definitely. I don't know anybody that at that time was knocked out by a Panzerfaust.
As you were going along, what were you mainly looking for, Joe? What were your main worries?
Tigers and panthers.
what were the reputation of the tiger and the panther then?
Well, we just knew that we had no weapons to combat it except the 17 pounder, and even that wouldn't have penetrated the front plate of the tiger. It would probably slice off, you see, but if it hit the turret or anything, you'd knock it out. You could knock out a tiger on the side easier than the front. The front had a very thick, I think it was 11 inches thick or something. That was the main thing about a tiger.
You saw the tiger and the panther as well as being vastly superior to the firefly or the Sherman.
The panther was slightly less than the tiger. The tiger was the real menace one.
Did you actually fear tigers and panthers?
We all did, yes. I mean, if it was reported that there were tigers in the ring, everybody immediately got the willies, you know, they became alert.
What about Mark IVs? You know, the ordinary German tanks.
We were equal to the Mark IV, I think. I think we could knock out Mark IV easily enough. They were quite good tanks, probably as good as... They might have been even as good as the Crusader, or maybe better than the Crusader. Probably were. They were very near in design to the Cromwell and the Comet. In design, the shapes and the turrets and that. But... I think we, generally speaking, had a sort of equality with the Mark IV.
What about some other German... we've talked about the 88. What about the Moaning Mini, the Nebelwerfers? I mean, were they much of a problem for tanks, or...?
I've never actually been under fire from a Moaning Mini. I don't know, except that there's just this hellish noise that they made, and...
You heard that?
It's slightly demoralising, though. We've heard that quite often, yeah. But you always sort of say, well, it's all right, it's not aimed at us. And they say that the shell that hits you, you never hear. When you hear it, it's not going to hit you, sort of thing. That's what you should say, but...
Did you come under much artillery fire, German artillery fire generally, or had they been cleared away?
Well, actually, you never really knew what's fired what. A shell landed, it was obvious it was probably fired from a howitzer or something like that, but you never really knew. Mortars knew, because they had a particular sound. It was a crack. Mortars were fairly close range, you see. They weren't long-range weapons, so you had the crack of the mortar being fired, and then the noise and the explosion. But that's about it. It's not nice being mortared, because, I mean, you're in a slip trench, and it's not like a gun firing a shell along. It comes down at you, you know, from above. It's as bad as being bombed, really.
When you were stopping overnight, would you dig a slit trench, or, I mean...
No, we didn't, but the infantry had to do that. They did that.
But you didn't?
No.
What would you do overnight, then? Would you sleep in a tank or under?
You just sat up and slept. And very often you got a rum ration. Depending on how long you'd been in action and what the weather was like, the quarter came round with rum. It had probably been thinned a bit, but it was still thick and syrupy. And I can remember one night when I was picked for guard, and I was walking about the rada when the quarter came along with the rum ration, and he said, how many have you got? And I think I still had the 17 pounds in there, and I said, I've got... three of a crew beside myself. There was only four in the firefly. So he gave me a ration for four people, and I climbed up on the tank and opened the hatch and shouted down to the rest of them, rum rations here. Nobody woke up. Andy Mayers, of course, he couldn't wake him up with anything. So nobody woke up. So in the end, I said, well, I'm not going to waste this rum ration, so I drank the lot myself. And I never realised just how potent it was, because I was as drunk as a log for the rest of the day, and I thought to myself, well, I didn't, but they told me I wasn't fit to drive a tank after it in the morning. So, I don't know, I got in there and drove just the same.
So
that was a little incident about the rum ration.
So you wouldn't sleep under the tank ever?
Well, I'd already mentioned on Hill 112 when we dug a big hole. That was okay. Well, very often you slept, not so much under it, but probably your head under it at the back of it or at the front. You never went right under it, because it's possible a tank could slowly sink and you'd be squashed. So
now, as you were going along the lanes, you know, during this period in the bocage, would the machine gunners or the gunners ever fire it on either side?
Often, because there was often snipers and trees and things, and anything like a church tower or a high building, or anything, there was always an observation post there. And of course, it was general practice for somebody to have a bit of firing practice on a tower, or in Holland, for instance, it was windmills. There was always an OP at the top of a windmill, so you always knocked the top off of every windmill you could.
So you thought there might be. You wouldn't know, but
just in case.
And would you just fire into a wood or, you know, into a ditch as you went along?
Not unless it was something you just suspected something here. But some of the gunners got bored and they would just fire off rounds just for fun.
Now, what about incidents in the fighting? I mean, are there any you particular? I know there's one at Bursa, you remember, but are there any before that you know, just particular incidents you recall?
No.
Or close escapes or.
No.
The Veer Road before Bursa, I wondered whether you remembered anything about that.
Yeah, well, there was one incident that's probably the only time I ever fired an anger. And normally, if there was a junction of a road, or if you were camped in a sort of wood, in this particular case, we were in a wood, and there was a road, a sort of slight hill, led off, and you had to sort of sit at the top of that road in your tank with a Bren gun mounted on the top of the turret. And the idea was, in case anything, there was nothing down that road but the enemy.
Is this the Veer Road?
This is in the Veer sector. I'm not sure whether it was actually in Bursa or not, but we were back in harbour for a spell. And I was in the, it was a bit boring, really. You sat there doing. It wasn't wireless. Well, it was wireless watch as well. I mean, you had your earphones on. And you were on your own in the tank. The rest of them are in the bivvy, fast asleep. And you were on your own, just sitting there. And suddenly, in the distance, and in silhouette, probably, a motorcycle combination came up with black. And it was an infantry, I'd just given him a cup of tea, I just made tea in on the top of the back of the tank, and I'd just given this infantry man a cup of tea, and he said that there's nothing down that road but Germans, you know. And I thought to myself, well, these two coming up. And then I suddenly realised that we didn't have any motorcycle combinations, that we just had motorcycles and no combinations. So I thought, no. Put the magazine on and cocked the gun and fired it at them. And it was a funny sensation to feel that you were actually killing somebody, you know. You just, the turn, if they hadn't turned, I think I would have let them come on. I don't know, but they swung around to go back. They realised that the tank that they saw at the top of the road was British and probably saw the yellow bull, I don't know, but they turned, and you're told that if you don't let them escape, if they go, because there was information to tell. Anyway, that's the only time, and the infantry.
You hit them then?
I hit them, yeah. That was fairly close range, probably about 200 yards, and the infantry went down, so they got all the spoils, the watches and things off them.
But you felt a bit strange about
it. We're both dead, yeah.
And any other incidents in that time?
No. Most of the time you heard on the ASAP people in trouble, you know, being knocked out. And then it was sometime after that we met the Americans coming down from the Content Peninsula, near the Americans. That was their sector, really. We were next to them. And the first thing I thought when I saw the first American was, he looked like as if he was out for a walk. He was dressed and... in fact, one of them I saw had a walking stick and looked as if he was out for an afternoon walk. Well, different uniform, you see. So, we knew then that the gap was closing up. I can't remember where we went after.
Now, what about this thing at Bursa where you went round? Do you want to tell that story?
Well, A Squadron were getting pretty badly armoured with this Tiger in the woods up on the a promontory, a sort of small hill he was. And he was dug in, reversed back, probably into an emplacement of some kind. and every now and again he was coming out and choosing his time and target and knocking out A squadron tanks on the slope. I don't know whether they were in too obvious a position or not, but they were getting, I think, six or seven tanks, I think, knocked out there, I don't know. And eventually Sir John came on my tank, which was a Firefly, and we did a wide detour around the back, along roads and things.
Did he replace Shaw then for this?
I think so, yeah. So well, he must have been in the turret. He couldn't have been outside the turret when the 17 pounder fired, because it was the flash from it was quite something. And he didn't have a tin hat or anything on, he just had his belly on. And anyway, we went round and crossed several open bits of ground, and we saw some German infantry, and they were mostly running away. But when we got to the...
Did they fire at him?
I wasn't alone. I think there was two tanks, two other tanks behind me. And anyway, we got up to this big bank, and he chose his spot well, Sir John. He knew what he was doing. He obviously read the map quite well. And I sort of stuck my nose into this hedge, and the gun was just above it, sighted on the tiger up in the hill. And all I wanted to see what was happening, so all I saw was a flash. When Bertie fired, three rounds, I think, he fired, quickly, one after the other. Andy must have been on his game, too. He must have loaded quite fast. Anyway, we got to...
Now, you'd made special arrangements to get out quickly, hadn't you? Could you just explain that?
I think Sir John did that. I think Sir John knew that. He said something about you're free to reverse, so engage the gear and keep your foot on the clutch. And he gave me the instructions. And I can remember my foot was on the clutch, and it's a fairly heavy clutch on the Sherman. You know, you have to press it in hard. And I got a twitch in my knee, and it was going like this, you know. And I was scared because I would let the clutch out and then foul the whole thing up. Anyway, the shots went home. Apparently, we knocked out the tiger.
You got behind, so you were hitting the back of, or the side of the tiger. Was it the back or the side?
The side. I don't think we would have knocked it out so easily if it had been facing us.
So you'd gone round behind it and got...
We got one right round on the side of it. The thing was coming out of the emplacement.
Did you actually see that this tiger?
I actually saw the tiger, but...
Were you from the side then?
Yeah. When the shell hit, it was just a flash. And I think by the time we fired the third shot, it was a question of getting out as quickly as possible. Because, I mean, the 17 pound of flash was being so obvious, there'd been all sorts of... We didn't know what the Germans had behind. They probably had an 88, something like that.
Close to you.
We were never fired on after that.
So when you'd fired, did you release the clutch then?
Yeah. My foot was right down on the board. When I must have jarred the crew. Well, I jarred myself because we shot back quite violently and managed to... It was the ground wasn't too bad because I managed to swing the one track round and you could turn on a sixpence practically, because if you steered one back and one forward, you went round, you see. So we got going back again and I never saw anything else. All the Germans that we saw on the way up had disappeared.